You're invited to talk about teaching. That's really a double honor. So I tend to record these things simply because I have graduate students at home who are always interested in hearing what happens when you get in front of an audience of various kinds. And so for that reason, I plugged in my little recorder. Oops. Again, thank you very much. It's an incredible honor to be invited and wined and dined and treated like an absolute king, at least so far. My plan this morning is to talk a little bit about a variety of things. I'm going to begin with a discussion, or at least a few comments about sources of information. And these are sources of information that really apply to what I'm going to talk about through sort of the middle of the presentation, which is the nature of our students and how you try to focus on some behavioral changes that you believe maybe are warranted. And there are two or three times then during the talk where I'm more than happy to simply stop and deal with any questions that you may have. So feel free to raise your hand anytime. I do understand that I'm also preaching to the choir, and the choirs are always the most appreciative folks. So the fundamental question is then, how do we really turn this group of people? Well, let me back up. If Missouri is anything like the University of Nebraska, then every year there are 3,000 or 4,000 18, 19, 20-year-olds walk in your front door. And these 3,000 or 4,000 young people really represent the future of your nation. And in many cases, you can think of them as representing the future of your world, because you have no idea where they're going to end up 25, 30, or 40 years hence. They also represent a truly staggering supply of human resources. And if you'll think back on all of the things that seem to have made a difference in all of our lives, routinely it's actions by other people. Very often positive actions by teachers, positive actions by scholars who let you be a part of their scholarly activity in some form or another. So they really represent not only an obligation, not only a pain in the neck sometimes, but they really are a major resource, and they're something of great importance. The question is, really, how do we turn these people into the kind of folks we'd like for them to be, which are, of course, skilled communicators, not only writers but speakers, critical thinkers, those that don't necessarily just accept carte blanche, everything that they're fed, and habitually analytical citizens, people who are always asking some of the right kinds of questions about things that are going on in their nation. People have really try to have at least a true understanding of the breadth of human intellectual endeavor, really spanning the arts and humanities and social sciences and the sciences. So in terms of what I'm going to say about how to answer that question, how to accomplish that, I'm going to begin by talking a little bit about sources of information that I've encountered in the last 40 years. Not so much these sources are ones that you yourself should take advantage of, or that I'm recommending that you take advantage of, but ones that we can think about these as sort of models of how to learn our business when it comes to teaching. I spent about 2.5 years, almost 3 years recently, as chair of the University of Nebraska's General Education Planning Team and General Education Advisory Committee. Our university promised the North Central Accrediting Association that we were in fact working on revising our general education program so that it would be an outcomes-based program. And once that assurance was made, then they needed a sucker to a volunteer, a faculty member to take charge of that. And so I was asked to be chair of that, and we spent then 3 years meeting every single week. And the planning team that had mathematicians, administrators on it, English professors, someone from journalism, sort of a diverse group, we met every other week. This was a small group of 8 people. And then on alternate weeks, we had the large university-wide advisory committee to design this so-called achievement-centered education program, and I'd be happy to talk about that toward the end if you'd like. But what's the value of this experience to an audience such as this? During every one of those weeks for that whole 3 years, and that assignment included not only those meetings, but also workshops that the association of, conducted by the Association of American Colleges and Universities, workshops on assessment, workshops on curriculum design. It involved bringing in a number of consultants from AAC and you. We talked about all of those things. But what that was really a three-year exposure to the rest of the university. And as a sort of a comment to particularly young faculty members or graduate students, I would say that it is so easy and in many cases so necessary to get completely involved in your own research, because if you don't get it done, you're not going to get your degree. And if you don't learn how to be the scholar in your discipline, your specialty, then you're going to fail. But by the same token, of regular contact with those other faculty members from other disciplines who have totally different criteria for evidence, they have totally different criteria for success, they have totally different vehicles by which they demonstrate their achievement and success. Suddenly, that encounter, over and over and over again, hearing them talk, puts ideas in your mind that are very useful. I found not only useful in terms of actually doing the things, but also encouraging you to think a little bit differently than maybe you've been thinking so far. In other words, what does a biologist gain by thinking like a historian? What does a biologist gain in terms of teaching strategies, in terms of making your job more enriching, more meaningful, making you feel like more successful at it by listening to how the musicians do their work? And I have a specific example of that in a minute. So I think it may be worthwhile, if you're bored sometime, go to the AACNU website and just take a look at the resources that they have to address some questions that you may have about the millennial generation, about liberal education, especially those of you who are dealing with the general ed courses and programs. And then the new Achievement-Centered Education website of the University of Nebraska is a pretty good resource, and I may come back to that toward the end. Almost every conversation that I've been in recent years with administrators who are associated with student affairs in any way, the word the millennials has come up. A few years ago, I taught the large introductory biology course virtually every fall since 1966. My first teaching assignment as a brand new faculty member at UNL was 7:30 Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday mornings in an auditorium with 362 people, and the department secretary didn't realize I was a new faculty member when I showed up, and I started asking for my key. And so she found out that I was a new hire. She said, "Oh, and here's your assignment." And so I walked over there and took a look at that auditorium. It was about like this one, except it went back three times as far, and the only audio visual was an overhead projector and a microphone. So I've been dealing with those large classes now for a number of years. And a few years back, I found myself wondering what in the hell is going on in this group. Why aren't the things happening that I think should be happening? Why am I not getting certain kinds of questions? Why are people who are not doing well on exams, why aren't they barging into my office asking for help like their parents did? What's going on? And lo and behold, one day we got an announcement that there was a visiting speaker, a faculty member from New Mexico State, and I've forgotten her name, was going to talk about Generation Y and the millennials. And I said, okay, I'll go listen to that. So I went to listen to that lady and came away simply stunned. And the answer, what's going on in my classes, was right there. And the answer is, these are not your parents. You know, these are the millennials. So I would encourage all of you to get on the web and just type in Generation Y in Google, or the millennials, or something of the sort. This is a label that was put on the current generation of young people, really by the business community, the marketers, because they're such a source of purchasing power. And yet, those millennials, they seem to have certain habits that are not necessarily conducive to the kind of activities that we college professors would like to encourage. So, go take a look at those folks. The other next sort of source of information is being a faculty member at our Cedar Point Biological Station since 1975. What happens during a field course when you go teach field biology is that you end up spending weeks in residence with a number of undergraduates, most of whom are juniors and seniors, or sometimes sophomores. Spend a lot of time at the dinner table with them, and the breakfast table, and the lunch table. You spend a lot of time riding around in vans. And routinely, over that 30-some-odd years, when you get in the van, start going someplace, their parents, back in the 70s, would start talking about biology, and they start talking about ideas. For the last 10 years, this conversation in the back of the van is mainly about one another, about social activities, and about my fellow faculty members. And of course, they don't even act like I'm there. So, you know, we'll get in, we'll head off to the prairie 10, 15 miles away, and next thing I know, I'm listening to all of this stuff going on in the back. I think, oh my God. So, listening to your, you know, stuff that's on the screen, finding out what the professionals are talking about, the AAC and you, finding out what the business community is talking about in terms of your students, and listening to them as they talk about what's good and what's bad and what works and what doesn't work. I also, a few years ago, and I have some data here in a minute, it's sort of subjective data, but it's nevertheless data. Years and years and years ago, it became, well, very quickly after I became a faculty member, a couple of years, it became obvious that some of those students were going to come back and ask you for letters of recommendation. And so after that went on for a while, I realized that those people who were coming back to me, like Bill, maybe a year after they'd been in school, were very often A students, and I didn't have any idea who those people were. Out of a class of 200, 250 students, I might give 30 or 40 A's, or at least B pluses, and I couldn't recognize them. So I started giving out cards, little 3x5 cards, and said, okay, if you will put this information on this card, who you are, where you went to high school, your hometown, what your major is, all this stuff, and bring me that card for about a 5-minute conversation, I'll add 5 points to your last exam grade. So they started coming in, and I started finding out who my students were. After a while, then I started getting information about our students that seemed to conflict with what the advising system was telling me and what my fellow faculty members thought they were like. So at that point, and this has been about 10 or 15 years, I started handing out an information sheet. So I'm going to give you a copy of that information sheet. And I would encourage you to... This is all the way back. Oh, and I might borrow one myself. So I started putting this information sheet out And I actually made it the last page on the syllabus. And the first day of class, they fill us out and tear it off and leave it with me. And so I read through those. And I don't study them in great detail, but I do look at them. And after the second exam, I call in the top 20% of my class, sit them down for a talk, and pull out this information sheet and go through it. Now, you read these questions, you realize that they're a little bit intrusive. In fact, the IRB has not had a chance to look at these at all. And if they did, this whole idea might get jerked real quickly. But I would encourage you before the roundtables this afternoon to maybe fill this out yourself. And as you get together with your fellow faculty members, sit down and compare these sheets and just see what kind of diversity you bring to the table among yourselves, even though you're all members of a single college. My guess is that you bring a variety of ideas, exposures, and experiences that can, in fact, be tapped for teaching purposes. What I learned from this kind of stuff is that there are a whole lot of really bright students who do very, very well on standardized exams who have been given terrible advice. And they get this advice from a variety of places. They get it from their parents. They get it from their peers. They get it from their high school counselors. They get it from society as a whole. They set their goals way below their capacities. And when you tell them that, some of them get very angry at you. And one of them I had this semester who I said, it's okay to be a blank, and I don't want to insult anybody, but you really ought to be president of Harvard University. And that became a case of instantaneous hostility. And every time I saw her, I said, so how's the president of Harvard doing today? And it never got any better. So something's going on. I'll come back to this here in a minute. I've also dealt with, in terms of information, and I'll expand on this a little bit. 3 or 4 years ago, we've done extended writing in my classes for a long, long, long time, even the big ones. And a few years ago, as soon as the internet sort of got up and boiling and functioning well, and particularly as soon as our wireless network was established, those papers became so boring they were almost impossible to read, simply because they were so uniform, and so they really were just terribly boring. So one of my first acts a few years ago was to try to separate those students from the internet. And I've done this, and again, I'll expand on this too, and even in questions, and I can give you some. And I have another handout I'll give you in a little bit. So every Friday afternoon, we started doing an extemporaneous writing for the last 15 minutes of class. And they don't know what this is coming. They don't know in advance what they're going to have to write about. They know that it will deal something with biology, but they don't have a clue. And they don't have the internet in front of them. And even if they did, they wouldn't necessarily be able to deal with what they've been asked to write about. And I found that to be extraordinarily satisfying. Now, they also, if they'll do that and generate a whole page, something like this that you'll get to see a little bit, if they'll generate a whole page, I'll give them 3 points. And if they'll come back and within the next week, pick up that paper from a big box outside my door, type it out double space like a professional would, and then give me a whole page of single space self-assessment, I'll give them another 7. And if they do this every week for 14 weeks, then they are eligible for portfolio points. And I'll expand on that a little bit. Okay? So this is an out-and-out effort to alter behavior. But what you find out when you read these self-assessments and when you read this stuff, the type things, is that these students are very diverse. They are very different than you believe them to be. Their thought processes are surprising as they can be. Things that you think are terribly important, they totally ignore, and they admit it, and they are extremely critical of themselves. Extremely so, even when they're doing well. So this is a source of information. And finally, about 10 years, well, I will admit that the parasitologists at the University of Nebraska, like many college faculty groups, have for as long as I've been there, gone out on Friday afternoon and had a couple of beers. I mean, this is one of the privileges of being a faculty member, right? If you work all weekend, you could go drink some beer on Friday afternoon. So about 10 years ago, I had a graduate student in the lab, and I had a bunch of undergraduates in the lab. I've always had a lab full of undergraduates, and most of those have been women, simply because most college students nowadays are women. Most biology majors are women. And those are the ones that seem have always been receptive to ideas about doing undergraduate projects. So I've had some very, very, very good ones. However, about 10 years ago, I said to this graduate student, Ben Henelt, Ben, you know, there are a bunch of really, really bright young ladies working in the lab. How do we get them involved in the kind of conversations we have down at Berry's without inviting them along? You know, if you have any concern about your job whatsoever, you don't say to some 19-year-old girl, come on down to the bar, we're going to talk big talk. So Ben said, well, let's just go to coffee at 3:30, and that's pretty non-threatening, and everybody can go. And after an hour, then the grown-ups can go to the bar. So we started going to coffee Friday afternoons. And it turned into very quickly a weekly focus group in which everything was discussed, everything. Politics, religion, music, film, my fellow faculty members. Again, your ears are burning. Gender issues in the workplace, ethical issues in the workplace. This just went on and on and on. On any given Friday, it may be just total babble, but over the course of the semester, this is a mini course, really, in professionalism and in broad sort of the breadth, the value of a broad education. And as you might suspect, routinely the Friday coffee goes on and on until it intrudes on the beer drinking, and that's okay. I would really encourage you, if you can find some excuse to do it, to set aside some time that you can just go sit down off campus with a few of your students routinely, every week, religiously, week after week after week, and do it. Say, okay, what do you want to talk about? And just let them talk. You know, your ears may end up burning. So what do you hear and what do you get from all this stuff? Well, you hear about success and failure, and I think everybody who's been in our business hears about success and interesting stories about success. People who end up being in places they would never have believed they would be at the age of 19 or 20. You hear about failure, romance. You hear a lot of information from, over the course of my career at least, from at least 10,000 future citizens, some of whom have ended up being elected officials. You know, in cleaning out my office not too long ago, I found letters of recommendation for people who had been elected state senators, a letter of recommendation to Yale Law School for an individual who ended up being the Nebraska Attorney General. This while this kid was a college student. And if you're a biologist, at least, routinely your students end up being physicians or in the healthcare industry. My wife and I were at a social gathering not too long ago and walked up to the bar, and the bartender said, hello, Dr. Janovy. And I said, oh, you must be one of my former students. And I made this wisecrack about all my former students are either bartenders or doctors. And he said, well, I've just been admitted to medical school. So, kid was both. But yes, and then over the course of your career, you discover that physicians who are doing surgery on your own children are ones that you remember giving an A to in freshman biology classes, and that's happened at least twice. But more than that, you also see then this microcosm of your evolving nation. I'd like to go back now and come at this whole issue of your evolving nation from a different perspective, starting with something that should be very familiar to you, namely a grade distribution in a large introductory class. And the only thing that here is probably worth noting is this one that's in green, and that's what first semester of 04 and 05. So these are the frequency distributions of the grades in my last six big 101 classes. Okay. There's no statistical difference in any of those classes except one. And the only reason that one is higher than the others is because that was the first year we used this classroom response system, the clicker system. And I don't know if any of you are involved with that technology at the moment, but if you are, I'd be happy to talk about our experience, both good and bad. That was the first year we used it, and I decided at that point that in my behavior modification efforts, I was going to do something to get these children to obey the first rule of success, and we all know what that is. Okay? Write it down right now. You all know what that first... go ahead. Pretend you're in class. Write down. What is the first rule of success? No, go ahead. What is the first rule of success? Get up and go to work. Get up and go to work every day for the rest of your life. Get up and go to work. Now, if it gets vacation time and you get up and go to work, your spouse may get irritated, but this is the first rule of success. Get up and go to work. Well, a third of my students were not getting up and going to work. So I said, okay, we're going to do something about this. So for the first time in 30-some-odd years, I'm going to take attendance in the big 101. And so we had clickers, and we could do that by default. I just simply gave away too many points. That's the only reason. So. Now, if I were over in teacher's college, then I would have been alert to the possibilities 6 years ago of what this 101 class could teach me. 6 years ago, I just felt like I didn't want to write a final exam, the whole thing. So I started telling my students, this is 260 of them, started telling them a month before the final, half of these questions will be straight off your first three exams. Half of them. I promise you, I will give you half of these questions on your final, and half of them will be new from the stuff we've scoped, but half of them will be straight off those little tests. You have the questions, you have the answers. Made absolutely no difference at all in the grade distribution. And going back through the item analysis, it made no difference at all in that block of questions that they had already had and had the answers to. So some of them had obviously helped, but as a class, it made no difference. And so at that point, from the next year, I thought, well, I'll just tell them, I'll give them a few more of the questions. And eventually, I just gave them a massive test bank of questions. And I put it up on Blackboard the first of the semester, and I put it up on it. So there's one of those up on my website. I mean, these are, and I told them, I said, okay, I'm going to take as many of these questions as I can out of this test bank so long as we've actually covered that stuff in class. And now I might change a figure or two on the genetics question, or I might rearrange some of those answers, but they're going to be essentially the same stupid questions that have been asked in introductory biology forever. It makes no difference. I mean, absolutely none in the class performance. And the only thing that started happening was I started getting complaints because they didn't have the answers. so this semester, you know, this semester I said, okay, if you will actually type out some of those questions, answer them, and put them up on Blackboard, tell me why you answered them the way you did, then I will respond to them. And on my Blackboard site, there are about 505 discussion board entries, a lot of them anonymous, and well over half of those involve questions off of those out of that test bank, which they're asking for the answers. And they get the answers back. And furthermore, a number of those are exactly the same. In other words, student after student after student is asking the same questions about the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, something like this, which is really a very simple piece of binomial expansion and multiplying of fractions. So this year they had most of the answers, and it still made absolutely no difference at all. So something's going on that, in terms of their use of the written word, in terms of their ability to actually use text, in terms of their information handling skills, that I think my fellow faculty members simply don't understand, simply because they're not necessarily, they maybe have not been paying attention to what's going on in their freshman classroom. And finally, in terms of talking about what you learn from your students, I've always paid points. If I can recognize people on the street by the end of October, and in recent years that point total has gotten up to 10 points. So the criterion is, if I'm able to recognize you out on the street, and my own personal criterion is, okay, if I run into this kid just by accident somewhere, could I introduce him or her to my wife or whoever I happen to be with? If the answer is yes, as I go through that grade roster, then I'll just simply enter 10 points. So this is equivalent to making an 80 on an exam instead of a 70. Now, back in the good old days, a decade ago, and I did go back and take a look at this, and by the end of October, so they can't come in the last week, because I won't, that doesn't work. So by the end of October, about 10 years ago, I was really able to recognize in that particular class about half of those students, and there were almost 260 of them in there. So every time I saw that name, a face popped up. And every time I saw them on campus, a name popped up. That's pretty good. Over the years, that number has declined. In this last semester, out of 197, these two are afternoon sections, and the enrollment's usually lower in the afternoon. But out of this one, there really were only 20-some-odd percent that I could recognize. So you can't even pay them. At least mine. I was not able to pay them the difference between a 70% and 80% on one exam to make sure I knew who they were by the end of October. I couldn't pay them. So the interpersonal interaction has really, as far as I can tell, simply become eroded or begun to wither away. Now, I do accept the fact that during those 10 years, I became 10 years older. So the difference in our ages may figure into this, but something's going on. You've got to be able to pay people to make themselves known, and text messaging doesn't get it. So at this point, I'm ready to stop for questions, but I also then want to go on and extend this conversation about what you've learned from your students a little bit, and what kind of value that learning might take. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have at this point. Yes, there are a couple. The question is, what was the motivation for inviting? It's more than an invitation, it's a command. the top 20%, because they're the ones who are going to come back to me for letters of recommendation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it also goes back a little bit to the idealism of not wanting to give an A to somebody you don't know. And that's just personal. But statistically, those are the ones who come back to you for letters. Yes. Okay. So the question is, would I expand a little bit on the clicker technology and the classroom response system? Do you all have a week? We had, at the University of Nebraska, we had a reasonably difficult sort of knockdown, drag-out discussion over the company to buy. And that discussion was won by an individual who was an administrator who's no longer in that position. And I don't know, well, I'll give you maybe 30 seconds of commentary on the technology and then about a minute or two on the pedagogy. And then if any of you have questions, we can follow up. However that's installed in your classroom, it has to be easy and it has to be quick, and you have to be able to get your results back easily and quickly before it's of much use. We went with e-instruction early on the first year, and the university was not involved in that, and I actually physically borrowed the equipment from e-instruction. I went into, over the summer break, went into that auditorium, carried a ladder from my truck, put the receivers up there, drilled holes in the wall of the auditorium. I installed all that stuff myself, and it worked beautifully. And it was among the most fun things that I ever did. And that instruction, those receivers immediately put stuff into a CSV file that I was able to just get. It just went straight to my flash drive. In the year succeeding, we bought university-wide PRS Interwrite, and the security issues involving that software have made it difficult and time-consuming to use. And in the last year, at least, in the auditorium that I teach in, the software installation has made it so inconvenient and time-consuming and difficult that I'm not going to use clickers next year. I'm going to use 3x5 cards and for attendance. Now, the pedagogy, one of our departments tends to use this, that has a lot of pre-meds in it, tends to use this for with multiple choice questions. And so we're going to lecture for a little while, and okay, here's a multiple choice question that's integrated into the PowerPoint. So let's answer this, and then you can answer, you can respond, you feel confident, not confident. And my reaction to that is not very gentlemanly. I'm thinking, you poor little pre-med with your 34 ACT and your 3.999 grade average, how worried are you that you're not going to get this question right? You ought to be reading a good book, something like that. So the times that I have personally felt the classroom response system worked well is when I've been able to put some kind of a challenge up on the screen and ask them to address that challenge, and then come one that's not necessarily one that doesn't necessarily have a pat answer, and then let the students see how their friends deal with that. So, for example, here's a group of butterflies up here. Now, write the null hypothesis that addresses the question, the problem of whether or not these are the same species. And so give them 5 minutes to do that. And then you give them 8 or 9, null hypothesis wording, something like this. So it becomes a discussion dealing with some thought processes that go beyond a multiple choice question. And when I've used it in that way, it's the students have appreciated it. It helps to break up the attention span problem, break up the class a little bit. By the time, if you use it regularly, at best it will cost you 10% of your class time. So in a, say, a 45-minute, if your class is officially 50 minutes and you give 5 minutes for questions, then a clicker every day will cost you 5 minutes. So that's essentially, you know, 10% of your time. So if you're in a course where content is so important that you've got to, you can't give up that 10%, then you're going to be, you know, then you have to think that through just a little bit. The attendance problem is one that is rampant, at least at our institution, and to the extent that I've had conversations with other departments about it, and the ability to use that classroom response system by default as an attendance taker, I think is the most powerful aspect of it, for me at least. So I don't know if that answers your question or not. I think for any of you who are involved in that clicker technology, my advice would be make sure your IT people help you in a way that makes it easy for you to use that. One of those PRS versions, for example, if you ask two clicker questions during the course of a period, it gave it to you. You know, those responses came back as sequential entries in a CRS file. So if you went back then and sorted them, you would end up with each student who was there would have more than one entry. And suddenly, then it takes your time to find a way to put that into your real grade record. This year, we also had major clicker registration problems, and no matter how much some of those students tried to correct them, it never really got corrected for about 10% of my class. And I don't know whether those problems arose because of the attempts of our IT folks to link that with Blackboard or to link that with your class, you know, your roster as entered into Blackboard by the system. I don't know. But faculty time, the time on task of doing education as opposed to data entry, those two things have to override everything else as far as I'm... And that's my take on it. I don't know if that helps or not.
Indicating, as you said, if you use it right, cognitive understanding of the students significantly increases in large classroom experiences. So I'm curious to know how whether this is really going to be used here in our large classroom.
Yeah, how many of you use it?
Now
that's critical to have the right hardware and the right software. And again, I'm not a software expert, but PRS, at least our the system that we now use, everything goes into a single database, a proprietary database file. And the more you use those clickers, the bigger that file gets, and the more your time is taken up. A year ago, I sat down over the course of a couple of weeks and simply timed the amount of time that I spent waiting on software of all kinds relative to teaching. And it turns out that that's at least a full week of work a semester. It's just spread out, and you don't realize it so much. But the amount of time that you spend just sitting there waiting for software to load is significant nowadays. Yes, it can be. Question about that?
But we also face the registration issues, the lots of different things. But of the emails that I receive during the semester, I get a great number of emails that are concerned that the clicker is in some way influencing their grades, either because they were there and was their grade reported or whatever's going on. And in a sense, while they're very engaged in technology, they still don't trust it. How we even use it for attendance, because I've not come up with a way to make kids buy them. I mean, I give them extra credit to buy them. I know Jan does the same thing, but the reality is I can't even force them to buy the book. So the clicker becomes sort of an issue there too, and so that means that they're saying, well, how are you going to use it for attendance?
Well, and that's a good point. So the question is, how are you going to use it for attendance if they won't even buy it, or they won't even buy a book? I also put a sign-up sheet up in the front of the room, and if you're not convinced from what you see on the screen that your clicker has clicked, then make sure you put your name up here. But you're absolutely right about the software and the hardware and how easy that is to use and how reliable. So anybody else have any questions? Yes.
I have a question. This is something might find a little strange, but if we cut the internet off from campus, I'm being serious, if you just one semester cut the wire, as well as cut all the cell phone communication from campus, do you think kids would learn more?
So the question is, if we just cut off all information technology for a semester, would the students learn more? Have you read this book, The World Without Us? Yeah, any of you in here have gotten that book? I would suggest, this is a thought experiment about what the world would be like without humans, what would happen to New York City over the course of 10, 15, 20 years, for example. And what you've just posed is a dynamite thought experiment and probably worth a bestseller book. I would encourage you to write that book immediately. Because if you don't, then I'm going to. that's an incredible question. What would happen if you just cut it off? It's probably worth doing, just to see. I think the first thing that would happen, I don't know. First thing that happened would be there would be a lot of significant other relationships that would either become very much stronger or would disappear altogether. And so most of the conversation I hear about on cell phones, for example, are with significant others. And secondly, the interactions with their parents would be diminished quite a bit or enriched because they'd be talking to them one-on-one. So those two things would be the number one impact. You might find students actually back in the library handling books. When I go to the library and handle books, I usually get an allergic reaction because of the dust. And so Claritin sales might go up a little bit. But on a little more serious response, I do talk about teaching with a lot of my colleagues, at national meetings and regional meetings. And invariably, somebody will say, I quit using PowerPoint. I just got rid of it and went back to notes on the blackboard, and the students loved it. And one of the things that happens, I think, without information technology is that whatever you're doing gets done at a human pace rather than a machine pace. And doing something at a human pace I believe has some real merit to it. So it, my prediction would be that's the number one thing that would happen. Everybody would go back to doing their business at the pace human beings do it, rather than at the pace your computer does it. And they'd probably be better on for it.
I'm sure you grappled with it, but this question has to do with the great distribution and you offering to buy points. And yet that left-hand side of the curve just seems to be persistently, there's a significant portion, not a large portion, but a significant portion of students that ultimately become citizens, that need to know biology. Have you got any strategies that you think that have helped bring some of those
The question is, do I have any strategies that have helped bring some of those at the left-hand end of the grade distribution up a little bit? No, but I will talk a little bit about, if I have time, about the Friday writings and the writing activity in general. And a short answer to that is, you discover in a hurry that there are people who are thinking in rather mature, productive ways and who communicate pretty well but simply cannot take a multiple choice test. They simply can't do it. And you also have people who need to have administratively dropped the class but don't. And so some of that lower third of the class involves personal phenomena that you don't know about and don't have any control over, and whether that's family medical issues, family financial issues, family social issues, alcohol, drugs, depression, whatever it is, you just don't know. And so some of that I'm fairly certain is involved.
Have you ever tried to suggest to the students that they
No, the question is, have I ever suggested to them that they need to drop the class? No, but I get asked, should I drop the class periodically? And I think, the question is always, what's your major? And, will a D keep you from taking this class over again? And if so, don't drop it.
So actually,
Well, check with the IRB first.
No, this is the education evaluation system. I'm going to actually ask the students to write on a slip of paper in a sealed envelope what the grade they hope for and the grade they expect is. Because what that distribution says is students walk in saying, I'm going to get a C minus, and they do their damnedest to get a C minus despite all their best efforts. My course has a strict, 90-80-70 distribution. I tell them ahead of time, I tell them where the points are, how to get it.
Well, this is so the question is, does this distribution automatically put the idea of a C or C minus in the mind of a student? If you go back and look at my syllabus, I always promise them if the class average is 75% or higher, then I'm sort of stuck with a pretty close to 70, 80, 90% grade distribution. And I always promise them that if the class average goes lower than 75%, there will be some scaling involved. So their parents, if one of their parents had come out of high school with high B, A averages and was a very, very good student and made a C or a D on my first exam, that parent would have been in my office immediately. How do I change this? And my reaction would be, in Biology 101 at least, make a vocabulary list, study it until you're completely convinced you know it, and then bring it to me and I'll ask you questions about it. It'll show you right away how to study. And that's the most effective means that I have ever known to help a student who's not scoring well come up a little bit. Simply because introductory biology, at least, is a foreign language, and you study it like a foreign language. The last 5 years, I've probably said that same thing to to 100 students, and I can count on one hand the number who have actually done it. And I can tell you, who have come to my office and said, what do I need to do? And I've said, make a vocabulary list, study until you're completely convinced you know it, come back and I'll ask you questions. It'll show you how to study. It'll show you how to deal with this stuff. And fewer than the number that I can count on one hand have actually done that, and all of them have improved drastically. And this is with multiple choice exam taking skills in Bio 101. Now, I don't know if this will work in chemistry or physics or something else, but you know, I think that when a subject is vocabulary based, then you study it like a foreign language. That's the only thing that I've known that's really worked. For me, there may be some other things. Tutors never work. Never seem to. Except over in the athletic department. Well, I'm ready to go on and talk unless you all have some other questions. Factors at work that... I'm going to come back to information now. I don't know about Missouri, but we're pretty complex. At UNL, we have 8 undergraduate colleges. They all have different cultures. They have different governance practices. They have different interactions with the alums. They have different expectations. And so the institution itself is more complex than the average citizen thinks it is. This is nothing more than my impression from talking with not only my fellow faculty members, but lots of parents and lots of alums and lots of business folks. And this is their sort of their image of college. You go to school, you take your gen ed requirements, you get them out of the way, then you go the good stuff, which is your major. You graduate, you get a job, you get happily married, your kids are well behaved. Eventually you get wealthy and you have a planned giving gift that supports the library or something like that. This is how we tend to think about college also, at least my colleagues and I do. Or at least my colleagues do, let me put it this way. And in my view, from interacting with students, that view is totally wrong. And so this model, at least, and this is the information that my, this is an impression that's really strengthened greatly by those 3 years on the General Education Advisory Committee, in which day after day after day, we dealt with transfer students, we dealt with transfer students not only between colleges, but between majors, and we dealt with the issue of feeder junior colleges and community colleges, and how this enormously diverse body of human potential actually used our equally diverse institutions. And so this is kind of the model I sort of put together. You know, lots of different kinds of students, lots of different kinds of opportunities. The interaction between those students and opportunities is highly varied. And not only that, it's quite a bit different. And there are many more of these kinds of potential interactions than the average high school counselor understands. And when you add that to the real world, then suddenly that complexity is multiplied many times over. For those of you that are close enough to read, there's nothing really particularly significant about Oklahoma City. It's just, I had that map. I think I was going to, for my parasitology class, I was going to try to make a head louse epidemic or something in Oklahoma City. But that's also, it got too much of a hassle. So I just use it. Oh, but Oklahoma City is also an example of malignant urbanization on the Great Plains. I mean, it really is. There may be some other places that are equally so, but from having grown up in Oklahoma City, which is a wonderful town, I go back there now and I think, oh, what have these people done? Heterogeneity in the student population. This is stuff that you get not only off of the information sheets, but also you really see from the front of the class, and you hear from them. They vary enormously in all of these things. Some of them are working two or three jobs. Some of them have been in the military, going there. They have lots of co-curricular activities, some of them far more than they do curricular activities. Big ethnic diversity, gender differentiation, sexual orientation, lots of big range in reading skills. Their parents, anybody who thinks that appearance does not make a difference in today's world of advertising is absolutely wrong. There are always clearly cases of drug and alcohol abuse and significant others that are having a major impact on their academic achievements and how they interact with you. They are extremely heterogeneous. We tend to think about them and talk about them in exceedingly homogeneous ways. Biology majors, non-majors, those are the two categories of human beings. No, they're not, ladies and gentlemen. These are the categories of human beings. Here's some information off of those information sheets. This is sort of a summary of a year ago. I haven't done it for last fall, and I probably won't, because this information is not. Just ask, what foreign languages do you speak, and what have you studied for more than a year? And there are a lot of them. And Spanish, I can tell you, it's encouraging to see the amount of Spanish that is being taken now by young people and college students, at least at our institution. It's very discouraging to hear some of them tell you, as they will in the back of the van when you don't think you're listening, "Oh, my advisor said I don't need to take any more Spanish." Wait just a minute. You're going to be a physician. You have no idea who's walking in the front of your class. You have no idea where your child is going to go to school. You need to be taking more and more and more Spanish. You need to be practicing it. You need to be listening to that Hispanic channel. You need to be reading that Hispanic great neotropical literature. American Sign Language is kind of prominent among our students simply because they love it and they like the social interactions and they see the signers who end up in our classes periodically. Nobody's listed any computer code. I don't know that a single one of our students could program anything in even BASIC, as opposed to 10 years ago when they all could. None of them listed HTML, even though some of them deal with web pages. So even technologically, that this generation is supposed to be so technological is really distanced from the literary components of that technology. They really are. This is the surprising thing. Where have you been in your life? Okay. And if you ask the average faculty member at any large university, where have your 200 biology students been? They would say, "Oh, I don't know." But when you ask them where they have been, what kind of global experience do you have? This list comes up, and there are some surprising names on it. Iran, for example, is a pretty surprising one. Guatemala is fairly surprising. Costa Rica is not surprising at all. And the list continues. Saudi Arabia is surprising to me. Turkey is reasonably surprising. Venezuela is a little bit surprising. So this group in the fall of... let me make this statement with the understanding that I'm a guest and I don't have to live and work among you, and I don't have to be a guest in your home. It's a political statement. Okay? In this class of approximately 200 people, there were at least 30 19-year-old women who had better education than Sarah Palin, had more foreign experience, had had a passport longer, and could write and speak infinitely better than that vice president, than that woman who was chosen to try to be one heart attack away from having her finger on the nuclear trigger. Information age culture. This is the stuff, this is how they live. This is their hourly life. It's not my hourly life, but I'm being dragged into this, and if you are not being dragged into it, then I don't know whether to admire you or to encourage you or to pity you, but this is our lives, folks. Do you have an iPod? Yeah, what's on it? Do you podcast? Absolutely. Do you have a cell phone? If you don't, you're in trouble. So all of this stuff. So whether, you know, not only is the information age technology changing you, it's also changing us, and it's really redefining what a human being is, just like the molecular biologists have started to redefine what a human is. So that question, the biggest question of our time, what is a human being, is being answered right here at this university and at mine, and in part at least in terms of this information technology. So the question is not do you use it, but how do you use it, and how do you make it work for me to humanize me rather than dehumanize me. So the take-home message from all this stuff of getting acquainted with our audience is they're not their parents, and they're certainly not their grandparents, but they are your nation's future. So the question then is, what do we teach them? What do they really learn? But what do they really need, and why should we care? And I think we could all really answer this, so I'm not going to spend much. But I do want to kind of go through this a little bit. But I'll also stop with questions. Anybody have any other questions you'd like to ask? Yes. Yeah, so that's a very good question. Out of all that international experience, how much of it comes from international students going home and coming back? What are the circumstances? It's a variety of circumstances. Some of them are American citizens whose parents were naturalized and still have family back home, and in some cases, those parents are professionals who are fairly well off, and so they go home. And they travel, they take side trips on the way there and on the way back. So some of that is that. Some of it is high school group travel. Some of it is church-based, particularly to the Caribbean. Some of it, so it's a mixture of things like that. You're right. But the fact is, they've actually landed on that foreign soil and obviously stayed there for some length of time. Yeah. I don't know about you all, but my experiences with foreign travel have been really pretty good, with a couple of exceptions, and those occurred in Heathrow. So, anybody else? What do we teach? Well, yes, and this is biology now, so the question that you all will have to answer for yourselves is, in relation to your own subject. So what do we teach? And typically in biology, and this is a picture out of one of the first pages of Campbell, the book we used last fall, that's supposed to give you an integrated picture of life on Earth, from DNA to ecosystem. We talk about the nature of science. We spend a little time on what we call baby biochemistry. What's a protein? What's a carbohydrate? And so forth. We go to cell structure and function. We have to get through that before they get to it in lab. So you have about 3 or 4 weeks to get through there. Spend a time on Mendelian genetics. Depending on the faculty member, the semester may end here, not because of any idealism or beliefs, but because of lack of organization. We spend time on evolution, and when we talk about ecology, it tends to be predominantly things that we believe they will find useful, and things like nutrient cycling and deforestation and things of that sort. What they learn, and there's some literature on this, among the most interesting reading is this book, and I've forgotten the author, called My Freshman Year by an anthropologist. Some of you may know this book, anthropology professor who was young enough to disguise herself as an incoming freshman and moved into the dorms and sort of wrote this book on her own institution. But there really is quite a bit of research on this, on what our freshmen learn. And the answer is, most of what they learn is time management. So here's actually some exam scores out of my last fall's class. They're disguised a little bit. Now, we have to issue them an identification code that is neither their Social Security number nor their university ID number nor any parts of those things. So they all have special ID codes for every class, as far as I know, if we're doing it right. So 1-9 sort of learned that you have to study between your first exam and your second. 2-2 learned that even more strongly and didn't show up for the quiz. 2-1 is probably doing just fine. This one dealt with metabolism, and so there's some chemistry on that, and suddenly the vocabulary gets a little bit different. So this difference between first exam and second exam, or between second exam and third exam, is really an indicator of how well those students are adapting to whatever you're doing. So you don't even have to ask them, it seems to me. You just say, okay, what's happened individually to those folks? They do learn blackboard use. They learn where the laundry is, what the local bars are like. And some of them figure out where the quiet places are and how to get certified for something is what the advising system teaches them. Take this course, take this course, take this course, take it now, take it now, take it now, and you will get into physical therapy school. And that's not really what a faculty member would say to an 18-year-old, which is, go take the most exciting faculty members in the arts and humanities and social sciences. Go encounter the big ideas that human beings have struggled with. Pass chemistry, get the best grade you can, do well in physics, and eventually, you know, you're going to be where you want to be. But take people, not numbers. Explore everything the university has to offer you. Go to concerts, go to the museums, learn the life of the mind. It's not going to keep you out of physical therapy school. What do they need? And most of this list really comes from the Association of American Colleges and Universities publications and their data and their studies on largely what the business community is telling us about college graduates. They need transferable skills. They need to be able to do a problem in some area that they have not been working in. They need to be able to work with diverse individuals. It's the first thing you encounter out in the business world, people who are not like you. They're not like you in every conceivable kind of way. They need an ability to actually produce something as opposed to answer a question that somebody else has given you. They need to be flexible. They need to be globally aware. They need to have some analytical habits of mind. They need to not be afraid of stuff that is outside their immediate realm of knowledge and expertise. And if they're going to lead a successful life as any kind of a professional, they're going to have to learn how to learn over and over and over again. I would say that these attributes are largely independent of subject matter. But the subject matter then becomes the vehicle by which we try to impart these qualities or these skills or whatever you want to call them. So we're really talking about something that the professional educators have talked about in terms of content versus process. And so what you saw on what we teach was content, and what you're seeing here is process. And what's in the middle, what they learn, time management, where the laundry is their own acquisition of process, how to get along in their world. But we need to give them what they need to get along once they leave. How do you make them behave in a scholarly way and give them what they need? So it seems to me that the whole issue here is one of behavior rather than necessarily learning. You need to get them to do what we do. And so the stuff I have to present to you in the next few minutes is then some examples of trying to accomplish that in a variety of settings. The smart aleck comment about treating them like they get treated over in the athletic department really comes from, is this Ashley Montague, The Paeta Proposal? Do any of you know that book? Do I have that correct? Pardon me?
Mortimer Adler.
Yeah, okay. Ashley Montague, this is The Dehumanization of Man. It's the Ashley Montague. Okay, Mortimer Adler, yeah. So that really comes from that little, and it's absolutely correct. I'd like to go back now then to Bio 101 and talk a little bit about behavior modification and effort to kind of do this. This is a section out of my syllabus. Excuse me. And for those of you who may be wondering about vocabulary and content versus the glitz or the creative part of it, really three major exams and a final exam, which if they'll do certain things is kind of negotiable. But we do these weekly Friday writings, and I also count attendance. And if they do enough of this, then they're eligible for this. So that's a bunch of points that they have total control over. And this block right there is really kind of a system to try to change behavior through use of the grading system. And I don't think it detracts from much. So these are our behavior modification opportunities. This is actually part of what we might call a contract approach to teaching. If you'll do such and such to the extent that I'm going to ask you to do it, I know you're going to learn something that I can't teach you. Okay, that's where it comes from. So if you'll do it, then I'm not going to necessarily sit down there and go through your work in detail telling you how well you did it. I'm just going to grade you on whether you did it. I might make a few little comments here and there, but if you'll do what I ask you to do. You ask any student there in the first semester of the summer, sure, that's not too difficult. You know, you haven't figured out what I'm going to ask you to do. You know. So here's an example out of, the fall of 2007. Now, this is actually a piece of Red Groom's art. So interpret this picture in terms of all of the ecosystem, energy, and carbon skeleton flow that we talked in the last week. And they have 15 minutes to do this at the end of Friday, and they do it in longhand, and they have no clue this is coming. Now, this is a small model of asking them to apply what they've been learning to a novel, strange, and unexpected experience, an unexpected situation. Now, this is not a life and death matter. And nobody's 401k depends on them doing this in a particular way. There are as many different answers as there are people probably on Earth, and certainly as many as there are people in class. But this is just one little example. One of my students who had been traveled extensively in Europe took one look at that and from the front row said, "Oh, that looks just like where I've been." So let's see what might come out of this, okay? Here's an example, okay, of one week, and this happens to be, you probably can't read all that stuff, but here's what the page of writing looked like. And this student happened to be one that got picked out the first week of class simply because that individual wrote legibly and wrote in reasonably dark pencil or pen or whatever it was, and filled up the whole page and seemed to have addressed the problem. Okay. So as soon as I looked through that first set of papers, said, okay, I'll find one that uses the English language reasonably well, writes legibly, fills up the whole page, and I'll pick that student for the whole semester, and I'll scan everything that student writes, and I'll ask for everything that student writes electronically, and I'll assemble that portfolio as part of my portfolio. I'll take that student. Okay? So this is what it looks like. So this is what this individual did on Friday afternoon for about 15 minutes. This is, the student came back then, they have to do this by the next week. Came back and typed double space typing just like a manuscript. Okay? Just like a manuscript. If any of you teach literature, one of the oldest tricks in the trade is to ask a student to get a bestseller book, take it home, sit down, type out the first three or four pages on their own computer, double spaced, just type it out, word for word. That's what that bestseller book, that's what that John Grisham, that's what that Stephen King novel looks like. And so you're going to do your stuff in a way that it looks professional. And so that's all. So the behavior involved in translating, and that's not really the right term, transcribing, thinking central dogma theme, transcribing this into that, that's a piece of professional behavior that they're ultimately going to get points for. And this then is their self-assessment. And they have to generate a page. And it takes me about 15 to 30 seconds to grade these. I do have a half-time undergraduate assistant who will go through and grade these and give them the 3 points. And then the following Friday, I get this stuff back, and I'll read through these. And if they do everything they're supposed to do, I'll circle some stuff periodically. I'll catch it. And if there's a good idea in there, I'll put good. If there's anything interesting, I'll kind of underline it. If it catches my eye in those 30 seconds, and I'll give them the other 7 points. And so week after week after week. And those that don't take it seriously at the beginning very often are in trouble. Those that do take it seriously, or even halfway seriously in the beginning, after about a month, and they start seeing their grades accumulate, suddenly it becomes a more interesting and serious activity. And those that stick with it routinely start giving me comments back in their self-assessment. I didn't have many things underlined. What's wrong? You know, this kind of stuff. So they start, they're doing every week exactly what you and I do in our professional activities. We produce something, we address a problem that maybe we haven't been exposed to before. We do it in our own way. We follow that up with some kind of professional preparation, and we constantly assess our own success at doing it. So this is behavior, attempt to modify behavior. So here's one that I'm getting ready to pass out to you. This is one from this last semester. I do things periodically to give them. Well, you have. You can't give them the same stuff semester after semester. You have to. This is a little bit of a challenge. So if you're going to use campus vegetation, I'm sorry.
You take the pieces of paper and people look at it. Do they get it back before they write it?
So yeah, the question is what happens? Let's go back to. Oh no, that's sorry. I was just babbling and didn't notice that your hand was up. So what happens to this? We get it on Friday. It goes back in a big plastic box sitting outside my door, I promise, by Monday. So they have 5 days to go dig through that stack, find their paper, do the rest of this, and give this back to me. And then it usually takes me until about the middle of the week to get this stuff back in a different big box. And they have to go pick this stuff. All this stuff has to go in their portfolio. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I'm not going to handle all this. Could you do this electronically? I suppose. I find trying to do this stuff electronically to be really depressing. It's much easier to go home, sit down with a glass of wine in your favorite chair in your living room with a short stack of these, go through them, toss them aside, come back a little bit later, pick up part of it, you know. Paper is easier to handle. I use campus vegetation a lot. The problem with campus vegetation is, first of all, most of it's European, and so most of the structure of that landscaping is all contrived. And the botanists get all bent out of shape over this. The freshmen don't know any difference. To them, it's just plants. And so from that point on, all you have to do is figure out how to use them. And you just simply can't ask. You can't make the assignments the semester after. So you have to vary this in some way. So here's one out of last semester, and I'm going to give you the whole take on from this one. This happens to be my favorite, one of my favorites. I have two or three on campus. This is a catalpa, which you can't buy anymore because I think at least you can't buy them in Lincoln because the horticulture industry thinks they're weeds. Is that correct? Is there somebody in here? The catalpas have been banned from America, non-seedless cottonwood trees. Some of those things you can't really plant in Lincoln. So the 15 minutes was, when was this? This was actually October 3rd. No, I'm sorry. I didn't give you this one. I gave you another one. Well, at any rate, this is one they had to do. And actually, this is... let me go back. I hate it when people do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. Sorry, I just didn't plan on it. Oh, so, yeah, here's really the first minute of some student. If I were going to move my Russian sage to a new location, here's where I'd move it. This would be a good move because blah, 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 blah. Okay? So the one I'm going to give you, though, deals with politics, and I felt that I simply didn't have any choice but to deal with politics this fall in some way. Neutral. Based on your knowledge and experience in biology, answer the question, do any of the current candidates, president or vice president, understand the importance of scientific research? Answer the question yes and defend your answer, and answer the question no and defend that answer. So this is one of the oldest tricks in the teaching book, namely to ask a student to take both sides of a particular question. And this is a teaching technique that you can use in any class, in any subject. You know, see this painting on the wall? Claim that is worth several million dollars and a mind-changing piece of art, and it's the best thing you've ever seen. Now that you've written that page, turn right around and claim that it's total trash. And explain why. So this yes and no. This particular student turned out to be a pretty good one. Again, chosen for penmanship and sort of use of the English language early on. This is a student from a tiny community in south central Nebraska, a town probably of 500 people. From reading this stuff, you cannot predict the long-term ability, the success, based on anything that you see in those students. Where they come from, you can't automatically write them off. What they look like, what their skin color is like, where they come from. You take any 200 people at random from global population, pluck them out, put them down in an auditorium about like this one, you're going to get high quality physicians, artists, musicians, opera singers. I'm thinking right now, I had a national opera singer winner in the front row of my biology class last year, a freshman. You can't tell. You know, you just can't tell. And so every time you see some of this kind of performance, then you're reminded of it. Here is that same catalpa tree viewed in a totally different way. And for those of you that are going to end up in the round table in here, you're going to be asked to deal with this tree as a freshman would, just as an example. And I'm not sure what else I have. Oh, this is, I put in for you all. How much more? I have what, 10 more minutes? I love TGI Friday's potato skins. Probably because they're full of fat and salt and whatever, you know, besides stuff that makes you look. This particular one came from the vending machine in the building next to mine. Notice that I have circled over on the ingredients list, however, a bunch of vocabulary words from Bio 101. So, this is an example of looking for teaching resources that cost nothing, and yet, if used in a particular way, connect your subject matter with the lives of those students outside the classroom. So how do you do this with a TGI Potatoes, Friday's Potato Skins thing? You ask them on one of these, after you use this in class, one of these Friday writings, to actually explain that list of ingredients to their grandparents. And so this is a simple, highly effective sort of trick of the trade of using cheap stuff, readily available stuff, commonly available stuff, in some way that makes them think seriously about their family, about the language, about how they're going to interact with another person, and about the long-term effects of that, or the immediate effects of that. And a surprising number of them do this pretty well. You know, they really do it pretty well. And they do it seriously. And when they come back with this self-assessment, then they comment on how well their grandparents would have done, you know, would have accepted this explanation. I think what I'd like to do now is give you some resources. The ACE website is really a very, very good one. Every freshman that comes in next semester, next fall, will have to take 10 courses in which they have to produce tangible evidence for satisfaction of outcomes. And I've put a whole bunch of the stuff that I've talked about, including large lecture section, general education activities of this kind, up on my website. Teaching in Eden is a kind of an interesting book, and Outwitting College Professors is my latest, and that has... that's one that I actually gave away on the website for a couple of years, and finally one of the Pearson reps said, we should sell this, and so we did. Take-home messages. Information about your students really, I believe, ought to be an integral part of what you plan to do in the classroom. Teaching probably ought to be, nowadays at least, with this Generation Y, ought to be viewed as a behavior modification exercise as opposed to a pontification exercise. They probably need to be separated from their information technology on some regular basis, because if they don't, their stuff is just boring as hell. And I don't know, personally, I've never used Safe Assignment on Blackboard. I think it's an insult to the faculty member, and I think it's an insult to the student, but it sure gets used. And it would not be there if there wasn't a reason for it. And we probably ought to start doing, as faculty members, the same kind of stuff that their grandparents did. Namely, putting a premium on some kind of tangible proof that they've actually accomplished something that they can take with them and go show somebody. I think in the last 5 minutes or so that I have, what I'd like to do is pull up a portfolio and... and just show you what one looks like from my last semester. Incidentally, I believe that honestly that menu bars are among the most dehumanizing things. So I tend to not put them up. So this one is now 100 pages long, and I'll be happy to give it to you. I haven't put it up on the web just because the student didn't give me permission to do that, but I did take the name off. But this is one of those cases, well, first of all, our weekly writing exercises, they go just fine through the first 12 weeks, and then the last two, I make them, they have 2 weeks to do this, I make that a double kind of an exercise, so that it's really very formal and very challenging, and routinely I'll send them either to the museum or to the art gallery or something like that to deal with natural materials, biological materials in some context other than they, and this, and this, and they have to do some fairly formal stuff, and I'll show you an example of that. But if they do enough of this Friday writing, then they're eligible for portfolio points. And 50 points is a pretty good chunk. And that means they have to put everything together. I don't take these up. My assistant and I just sit over there. We go over early to the auditorium. We sit in the little break place, the canteen, and we look at them, or they bring them by. We say, okay, have you done everything the contract asks you to do? If the answer is yes, then you get your 50 points. And so we don't really handle this stuff. So there's the table of contents. Okay, what do we have? There's the syllabus. Goes on down here. Lecture stuff. Exam schedule. There's the information sheet. Here's the section on exams and quizzes. So all these exams are there. There's the bubble sheet with the name erased. And down at the end, after that, there is exam self-assessment. So part of this portfolio, they either have to self-assess every exam or they can do them all together. So this student really talked about, the whole experience of studying for the exam, how successful that studying was. I think this person is a nutrition major. Okay, now here come the Friday extemporaneous writings. And there's a whole bunch of these. So the first day, what are the best things you can do with your two plans to help you achieve science literacy in the next 15 weeks? So we talked about science literacy as part of the introductory material. What do scientists do? How do they think? So there's the self-assessment. Let me see if I can go down here and find the... this is all... students all put this stuff together. Oh, as part of the... what do we have here? Fill in scientific name. List 9 different changes that were personally observed since the beginning of the semester. Okay. Russian sage. There's the typed up part of it. There's the self-assessment. So, let me see if I can find the... Here's the last 2 weeks, and this involves the art museum. What kinds of biological materials and images do these artists use in their work? What narrative roles do these images play in the works of art? Given the narrative roles you gave, could your campus plants have served in the same capacity? And what have you learned about the perception? So they have to actually answer these four things, and they have 2 weeks to do these last ones. And here's the stuff. And that's really a very well-prepared paper. Given these narrative roles, I do not think my Russian sage or my morning light Japanese silver grass could have served in this capacity. Blah, blah, blah. And here's then an overall self-assessment of what the student has accomplished in writing for the whole semester. Now, here's some important stuff. They also get a lot of collective feedback. So this is my collective feedback, word usage. Comments about your Friday writings, follow up. Okay, so they have a lot of this kind of stuff, and I tend to refer to it routinely, and I email it to them all. The whole class. Now, collective feedback. Individuals get a few marks here and there, a star here and there, an underline here and there. Yeah. Okay. Defiantly as opposed to definitely. That was a strange one. You guys, quit using it. Sense and sense. Have wrote. Research is a noun versus a verb. Come on, folks. Talk like a professional. Okay? That's their feedback. They've gotten a lot of feedback. And then their overall assessment for the course. So they did 5 pages of that. And then every semester I also give my students a general comment. You know, they get to evaluate me, and so then I turn around and give them a performance evaluation. I do this for everybody. Here's the statistics. Okay, at that point, I think I'd be very happy to... What's my schedule and what am I supposed to do? I can answer questions. I'm at your disposal. What would you like? Anybody have any questions? Yes.
You talked about and I have a similar experience, and I'm just wondering, why do you think that it doesn't really seem to make much of a difference?
Question is, why does it not seem to make much difference on multiple choice tests at the class level if you give them the question? Well, what I do with this big test question bank, they'll usually have about 150 questions that pertain to the material, and I'll pick about 50 of those. So they don't have the exact... They know that what they're going to get is going to come out of a body of questions. I don't have any idea. I think that they simply... This is just a really subjective call. I don't think they can read. I don't think they can assemble. I don't think they can compare two or three sentences. I don't think they can take a multiple choice question and say, and make choice A a complete sentence and ask, is that right or wrong, false or true? Then take choice B and do the same thing. Take choice. And even 1 year, I tried a different format. So instead of running all these things together as a paragraph, I put A, B, and C, D down as a list, thinking that that's... Because one of my students at Friday Coffee said, yeah, every test we've ever taken in high school, the answers are there as a list, as opposed to running in like a paragraph. It didn't make any difference. So I don't know. It's just some, and maybe it's just me, but their parents handle this multiple choice stuff test very differently than they do.
Just to follow on, the class I'm talking about, it's an engineering class. There are 25 students. It's not multiple choice questions. It's actually derive and work a problem through. But the response seems to be the same. If the question is identical to a homework problem, example problem, previous exam problem, a surprising number of students have never seen it before.
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't have any idea. It's easy to blame the way they behave outside of class or what they've grown up. I don't think anybody knows.
Maybe off the, it's related to something else. You said, you made a statement that you had the document outwitting college profs up for a long time. Been motivated to... by Pearson to publish it. So, is it available now?
Oh, outwitting college professors? Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I wrote the book out of... question is outwitting college professors available? Yeah, just get it through Pearson. And I don't know if you can get it the second edition through Amazon or not. I simply asked myself a few years ago, why... keep asking, what's wrong? What's going on here?
I meant from a financial perspective, free versus now it's available online or available.
Well, I wrote, what were the financial issues involved in that? I gave it out as a PDF. Everybody responded to it sort of positively. I read a story in the Omaha World Herald about a couple of ladies who had published a cookbook on createspace.com. And so, I had looked at a number of those online publishing sites, and so I checked out CreateSpace. It seemed to be very easy. So I designed the book and put it up there, and it started selling like crazy immediately. And I made a fair amount of money in about 90 days. And about that time, the Pearson person came along and I said, look, this is going pretty well, nationally even. You guys ought to pick it up and I'll make a second edition. Well, the only problem with Pearson Custom Publishing is that you have to do your own book design and all that stuff. So there are a number of typos that are irritating to me, but no student has ever said anything about them. So there will be likely to be a third edition in which I correct those typos. I also have some suggestions from students, and I don't have any idea how much money I will earn off of it. I just don't know. Oh, and I won't know until March. I made about $1,500 in about 60 days last spring. That's gross. And I probably invested about $200 in buying copies and stuff and advertising.
I'm going to put you on the spot, but I know you give us an honest opinion. At dinner last night, he told you that at the University of Nebraska that he was on the campus committee to review the Gen Ed program. And you told us last night that you enjoyed the opportunity because he actually reviewed Mizzou's Gen Ed program and he asked some questions about the writing intensity program. Yeah. He looked at that. I just, from an outsider looking at a writing intensity program, because I never asked you that last night, and I know you'll give us an honest opinion. From an outsider, what did you think of it? Do you have suggestions for it?
Well,
I know a lot of faculty.
Yeah, the question deals with my investigation of the Missouri Writing Intensive Program. when one of the first things we did when we started reviewing the Gen Ed program at Nebraska was to get, we each assigned ourselves about 10 or 12 institutions of various kinds, small liberal arts schools, large public institutions, middle-sized schools, and we got online and tried to find out what they did in terms of Gen Ed. And strange as it seems, one of mine was the University of Missouri. And I got on there and found the writing intensive program, and I started looking at it. And I thought, and one of the things I found on the website, I'm not sure I could find it right this minute, but was a statement to students to not be afraid to enroll in those courses. And I thought, okay, it's kind of interesting. And I looked at those and I thought, this is a major investment of faculty time and talent. And eventually I talked to or had an email conversation, this has been 3 years, with, what is her name, Margaret Townsend, yeah. And she gave me some details of that program along with the budget. And then I think that I followed that up with, she may have told me this, that the University of Oklahoma tried to institute this same way but ran out of budget or wouldn't fund it. Her figure was something like $800,000 a year was what that program was budgeted for. And I don't know where, like I say, it's been 3 years at least since I've had that communication with her. I turned right around and emailed John Fauberg, who I know from teaching at our biological station, and asked him from the faculty member's perspective. His reaction immediately was, I'm pretty sure I can tell the difference in the students who have had a writing intensive course and who have not when they get into my class. He said he did not feel like it was an oppressive burden on him. I think he had taught one of those, but he was very positive about the effects of it. We felt that we didn't have the wherewithal, either financially or the human resources or the commitment, to carry that off at Nebraska. That we just couldn't do it, and furthermore wouldn't do it as a faculty. So our program is designed a little bit differently, and I can sure talk about that at some time if you want to. But you get on that ACE website and you'll find it. My feeling is, one of the reasons that I went to, in 101, an extemporaneous writing followed by self-assessment, was the conviction that nothing I did on their papers made any difference whatsoever. That all of those red marks, all of those grammatical corrections, all of that discussion about paragraph, every note that I could put there made absolutely no difference whatsoever. And so my personal decision was, you're going to do it yourself. You're going to learn to look at your own stuff that way. A writing intensive course, I think as long as the student understands what's going to be involved going in, you know, you're going to be asked to look seriously at your paragraph construction. You're going to be asked to come out of this course with an ability to focus on your grammar. You know going in that when you come out of here 15 weeks later, you will have been asked over and over and over again to study your own writing, and you're going to get feedback, and you're going to do it. Then I think no matter what the subject matter, it's got to help. It has to be worth it. So if you're still doing it and doing it successfully, congratulations. Yes, you have to yell back then.
Or we have to change the students? And I, first, I guess my question is, which of those two is correct? And if it's fixing the students that's correct, how do we do that effectively?
So the question is, are the students broken or are the faculty broken? And I'm not sure that broken is the right word. I would say...
And I'm not sure broken is the right word either.
I'd say there are forces at work that are outside our realm that are affecting our business. And I think that's maybe the mindset I would approach this problem with. Something's going on today out there in society that's affecting my job in a recognizable way, but I'm not sure I know what it is. I just know that I've got to deal with it, or my job is not going to be as rewarding and satisfying and effective as it would be otherwise. So I think that's kind of my approach to it. The students that I work with, and this includes some very, very good people from the freshman biology recruited into research. It includes people at the field station where you live with them for weeks on end and work with them. It includes people who come in with honor thesis work and work in your lab for a year or two. They all, if they see a real reason for doing something in a professional way that's going to pay off for them later, they will do it. And they're not incompetent in that regard. But they're just really different.
If you make the point again that they're different, is it just the lure of this will pay off for me in the end that helps us motivate them along?
Well, I don't know that that's the only way to their hearts to act like they act. I think they have to do something with their hands. You know, it's almost as if their whole world is so information based. I mean, they get thousands and thousands of messages every day. They get it from the advertising industry. They go over and sit down in the student union and the big screen televisions are playing constantly. You walk around the other part of the union and there's big screen TV with music videos on. And so whereas 25 years ago, a faculty member could walk in front of an audience and be a show person a little bit and generate some excitement by his or her own behavior and presentation and enthusiasm. Now you're competing with all of that media and you're competing with whatever's on their iPod. You're competing, I have students now who come walking toward me on the street that are plugged in like this, and they walk by and I'll say, "Hi, Jim," or whatever, yeah, this guy's name, and they go. And so there's something going on out there that's affecting our resources in a way that we have to adjust to if we want to keep encountering those resources. So, in a meaningful way. Now, so to go back to the specific example, their grandparents, you could say, here's chapter 11, 12, and 13. We are having a multiple choice question test with 60 questions on it on this date. This material will be covered. And I'm going to interpret this material over the next 2 weeks. They would open their books and behave in a way that you think they ought to behave. And they're opening those books, studying that material, working on the vocabulary. That's the behavior that you've got. And you can't get that behavior now. So you have to do something else to adjust what you want your product to be to what they will do for you. And so I'm not sure that that's them being broken or us being broken, but they just won't do what their parents did. So if you want them to walk out scientifically literate, at least from 101, you're going to have to do something to make them be that way. Well, the thing that I've tried is this Friday writing and self-assessment. And that's the only thing that I've found that seems to engage them in some way. I can't do it from in front of the audience.
I'm going to have to put this to a close and give a great question that you'll be able to address on our follow-up roundtable sessions as well. But we have lunch upstairs in the atrium. But before we break for lunch, let's go ahead and give Dr. Jacobs a call.
Thank you.
Kind of dissertation depends from the student's answer. Maybe I have to formulate it between semesters. Two questions that I wanted to ask that you asked on there in your forum about the last two books you read. Has this generation of students read fewer books? Is that the source? The internet is not complicated language. It's simple language.
Right.
Music, simple language.
Right.
Have they read fewer books? More books?
Fewer.
Fewer. Many fewer.
So why are you using...